people. That is now the company that is in the heart of the US federal government. That is the company now which has the data of every citizen in this country. And I think, you know, people should be freaked out, okay? If you're not freaking out yet, you should be. Because this, we have seen there is a pattern across history, across the world, which is this is what authoritarians do. They want as much information about the population as possible so that they can surveil them, they can control them, they can search out their enemies, they can target them, and they can punish them, and they can silence them. That process has already started in the US, and we see it in the US amongst the most vulnerable population. We see it happening to immigrants. We see it happening to foreign students. Now, that is just the test case, because these are the people with the fewest rights. But what happens to them is now going to come to other people.
We're going to do part two, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Carol Cadwalader, award-winning investigative journalist, her Substack, How to Survive the Broligarchy. And we will link to her pieces, The Dark Lord of Silicon Valley. Peter Thiel enters the chat. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
KB, Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is to check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Today, we bring you a special newscast in collaboration with Don't Shoot PDX and their associates. Thursday, June 5th. Marks 5 years since Don't Shoot Portland's successful lawsuit against the City of Portland and the Trump administration, demanding a change to police training, limiting their use of munitions, protecting the right to protest in Portland, and putting PPB's consistent violations on the record. In remembrance, the Black Gallery is hosting an immersive exhibit in partnership with Donovan Scribes and Portland Mercury's special Blackout issue, a retrospective of Portland's racial justice protests. I spoke with Teresa Rayford, the founder of Don't Shoot PDX, to talk about the remembrance. Hi, Teresa. Thanks for being here.
Oh, hi. How are you doing? I'm thankful for being here.
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you. So it's been 5 years since this lawsuit. Will you tell me about just like a brief overview of how the lawsuit came about?
Oh, yeah, well, obviously, protesters were being assaulted, excessive force, and chemical weapons were being used against people for exercising their First Amendment right to free speech, and all of that was being done during a global pandemic. So, obviously, you know, there's a risk of harm, a risk of loss of life, and as someone who has, you know, felt the violence that happens to people that are, you know, standing up for people of color. I've experienced the violence that happens when the state intervenes with your right to protest. And yeah, at the time I thought that it was important to kind of like put the science first so that even if they didn't care about what the demands were or they weren't valuing the lives of the people that were, you know, seeking recourse or some type of response or accountability for the murders of so many people, that they would think of the science and the implications and the health hazards that affect everyone. And maybe that would give them the consideration or at least the kind of understanding of what was happening with the global pandemic and the use of outdated chemicals in some cases against people during a pandemic. Maybe they would think like, oh, we're actually harming people. Because it's obvious with the use of violence against us that I've experienced, they don't see us as human. So with the science report, we tried to humanize the association of violence against people. And, you know, like you said, it was a successful endeavor. We were able to initially stop the city from using the gas, the tear gas, and the use of force. And then, you know, obviously there was a federal response, so we utilize the same information, science, and inspiration to kind of stop the federal response a couple of months after, so, which also, you know, stopped the violence.
J. Ashley Albies, one of the attorneys that helped Don't Shoot PDX win the case, told me about some of the details of the lawsuit.
In the wake of George Floyd's murder on May 25th of 2020, protests, as you know, broke out around the country, around the world, and police across the country responded with aggressive and unconstitutional force in response to those mass protests, and that occurred here in Portland as well. The protests in Portland started on about May 29th, and they continued every night for about 100 nights. Shortly after the protests started, Don't Shoot Portland reached out to a group of lawyers, myself included, along with Jesse Merrithew of Levy Merrithew Horst and Oregon Justice Resource Center folks, including Juan Chavez. And we talked about, is there anything we can do to address the tear gas that the Portland Police Bureau was using en masse against peaceful protesters? And we tried to think about what we could do. We were hearing from community members that were being impacted. This is also in the context of the COVID-19 outbreak where people were forced inside or to wear masks when they were in spaces together. But nonetheless, protesters filled the streets of Portland, often peacefully, and were subjected to tear gas and other munitions by the Portland police trying to shut down these protests. So a few days after the protests broke out, on June 5th, we filed a complaint styled as a class action complaint and sought a preliminary injunction or a temporary restraining order limiting the use of force by the Portland Police Bureau against community members. Don't Shoot was the lead plaintiff in that case, and several community members joined that lawsuit because they were injured and were seeking to represent the class of people who were injured by the Portland Police Bureau. A few days after we filed that complaint and we filed a motion for a temporary restraining order, which would limit the use of tear gas, the city opposed this motion, but the court heard oral argument on it a few days later. And on June 9th, the court, federal court, granted a temporary restraining order that was initially supposed to be for 14 days, but substantially limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of tear gas. This is significant. Throughout June and July and the next couple months, we filed amended complaints. We were adding plaintiffs, adding and expanding the type of use of force that we were challenging and trying to limit by the Portland Police Bureau. So it started as a temporary restraining order against tear gas, and it morphed into challenges and limitations on the Portland Police Bureau's use of impact munitions, the so-called less lethal weapons, pepper spray, the LRAD device, sound cannons, flashbangs, rubber ball distraction devices, these kind of what they call as less lethal weapons but are incredibly dangerous and harmful. We also ended up getting some restrictions ordered by the court on those types of weapons used against peaceful protesters as well. Eventually, we were able to file a motion for contempt against the Portland Police Bureau and the city for violating these court orders that limited the use of force. The court found that the city and the police bureau were in contempt for violating some of these court orders and ordered some remedies that I'll talk about in a second. But during the course of this litigation, documents came out of what, when the parties exchange information, it's called discovery. Documents came out of discovery that reflected a very offensive training slide deck that Portland Police Bureau had been giving to its officers. One of the primary documents that got the most attention was the prayer for this the prayer for the alt-right. It was a training slide that was pretty offensive and said really negative things about people engaged in First Amendment activity. There were other portions of that training which were pretty racist. And the plaintiffs, we received those documents during the course of litigation and were about to file them with the court. The city decided to release those documents themselves to try and get out in front of it, which caused a tremendous amount of public outrage. They spread far and wide as there was a lot of documentation about the use of force against protesters and the training that the Bureau had provided to its officers of this offensive material really only contributed to the frustration and outrage amongst the community about this use of force. We eventually won the motion for contempt, and as a remedy, the court ordered additional training for members of the police bureau that were using these types of weapons against the public. The court directed an internal affairs investigation into some of the instances of the violation of the court order. And Portland Police Bureau had to circulate the court order with all Portland Police Bureau members. They had to certify that they read it and understood the order. There was additional training on use of force at the protest that was ordered by the court. And the what are called the grenadiers, the officers who police some of these protests, had to demonstrate, the ones that use these less lethal weapons, had to demonstrate compliance with the court order and demonstrate that they understood the reporting requirements. Throughout the case, we were continually going back and forth with the city and continuing to get information and litigate. We filed a motion for class certification, which was eventually denied, but in that denial, the court identified some serious concerns. He denied it based on the class, a kind of technical legal issue, but he did note, the court did note, that there were substantial concerns about the Bureau's pattern and practice of use of force during protests, in particular against people engaged in peaceful protest. Ultimately, the parties were able to secure a resolution that included a monetary sum to some of the named plaintiffs, one whole dollar to Don't Shoot Portland as an organization. But in particular, we were able to secure a very strong injunction for 14 months, which limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of tear gas, which limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of impact munitions, which limited the Portland Police Bureau's use of rubber ball distraction devices. In addition, the Portland Police Bureau decommissioned, was forced to decommission all remaining inventory of RBDDs. We obtained an injunction that limited the use of aerosol restraints, and as well as the long-range acoustical devices, the LRAD, was limited in its scope and how it could be used. And that was in place for 14 months after the entry of this judgment. And subsequent to that, the parties filed a pretty massive motion for attorney's fees and were able to recover attorney's fees for the work that we had done.
You said that these were in place for 14 months after the suit was filed. Are any of these things still in place?
Well, the rubber ball, the RBDDs were ordered to be decommissioned, all the remaining inventories, and so that is something that people should be watching. The injunction itself lasted 14 months, but if those pop up again, we have this case to look to show that they were being used inappropriately during the protests related to George Floyd. And I think that all of these pieces of the injunction, while they have expired, helps create a framework. If moving forward these uses of forces pop up again, we have all of this litigation and this history to show that the Bureau used these weapons inappropriately against peaceful protesters. And if they continue to engage in that conduct, we have this to look back on and show a pattern of conduct.
Right. What were some of the most difficult points to win in this case?
There was so much that is to celebrate in this case. I mean, obviously it was disappointing to lose the class certification motion, but we weren't seeking money damages for the class. We were really seeking to limit the use of force by the Portland Police Bureau, and we were able to achieve that. So while it was disappointing to lose class certification by itself, it didn't have an impact on what the limitations we were able to achieve on the tear gas and on the less lethal weapons. And I think that is significant. And that's part of the strategy. It's always nice to win class certification to feel like you're representing everybody who fit that bill. But class certification as just a matter of law is really tricky and challenging when you have 100 nights of protest, different circumstances that led to the use of force for each decision. So it's not surprising that we lost class certification, but we really were able to obtain a good ruling despite that, which helped advance the case. I think for me, one of the most positive aspects of this case was just the community support and community involvement. I know that a lot of protesters that were taking to the streets were watching this case closely to understand what level of force they could be subjected to and what level of force was impermissible and would potentially violate court orders. So when we first filed the motion for a temporary restraining order in early June, we had interviewed many, many, many folks that were on the street who offered up their time and their experience and shared that with us, and we were able to put those experiences in front of the court. When we moved for contempt of the court order, we brought in community members that had been harmed and injured, and they were able to tell their stories to the judge and to the court and to the public, and that was incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And Don't Shoot as an organization, many people were really excited about supporting the work of Don't Shoot and their efforts to protect our community and to strengthen the rule of law and ensure that people had the First Amendment right to speak their mind and speak about police violence without being subjected to further police violence.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like community support around Don't Shoot PDX is one of the big factors leading to the success of this lawsuit. What else do you think lent to that?
Well, I think that Don't Shoot as an organization has always been transformative, has always been dedicated to listening and reflecting what's going on for people in our community. And they've now done a lot of art based from this information gained from this litigation and the experiences of community members. And they've been able, I think, to translate a lot of that to really powerful art and to really powerful political art, which can empower communities and tell stories and will maintain community power by sharing everybody's experience with each other. So I think it's contributed to Don't Shoot's organizational power. And I think they were out in front leading when we had to make strategic decisions about what course of action to take. Don't Shoot's input and their guidance was incredibly important in how this litigation stepped up and how it played out.
I asked Teresa how they were planning on celebrating the 5-year anniversary. And she reminded me that this is no celebration.
Well, we're not actually celebrating. You know, there's not a lot to celebrate when you're thinking about, like, the violence that's perpetrated against people, parents being murdered and all that. And especially now with, you know, the fact that, you know, we have neighbors that are being kidnapped and lots of people that are emboldened with white supremacist ideology and violence. There's nothing to celebrate, really. We're just mostly reflecting on the 5 years since then, and with reflection comes contemplation. You know, what do you do next? How do you organize? How do you rebuild a community so that you can be strong in supporting, you know, people that are going to be vulnerable over the next, you know, probably generation based on the work that's happening with this new administration. So It's just a time for reflection. I wouldn't say it's any type of celebration at all.
Yeah, that's a really good point of clarification. Thank you. There is this interactive exhibit with Donovan Scribes at the Black Gallery. Will you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So Donovan approached me to be interviewed for this work that he's doing with Portland Mercury. And we actually held the interview, which was videotaped at our art gallery, the Black Gallery in Northwest Portland. And because of the type of exhibits that we've done, centering the different things that we associate with in our organizing, I thought that it would be incredible to kind of establish an exhibit that, you know, showed what he was putting together for readers. I thought because there were parts of it that I consider art, especially like the photography and poetry and things of that sort, that having it showcased in a public space, since there aren't like protests and things happening now, that it will give you more levels and textures for reflection. People could come to a space and, you know, take quiet time, or, you know, come in and ask questions or share thoughts, or just, you know, kind of be reminded and kind of, you know, use that reminder as a call to action. And so that's what we did with the exhibit. I noticed early on in my activism that when I was out, you know, protesting, that when we had signs or banners or things that kind of spoke to why we were out there, that it would take people a moment to kind of digest that, and then they would want to process and learn more. And so I'm hoping that that's what happens with this exhibition, that people will be, you know, mindful that just because you're not protesting doesn't mean that you can't center social change.
Absolutely. What should people expect from the opening of the exhibit?
I believe I've talked to Donovan. There's, you know, there's Cy Stone and there's a DJ Ronan and Donovan Scribes and also Laciana. I don't know, Drury, I believe. They've all put these pieces together that are connected to their quotes and essays in the Blackout magazine. And so people can expect to see like a live version of that. Some of the artists will be there. Donovan has told me there might be maybe 5 of the 11 artists there that'll be on hand to kind of speak. I've asked him to share his thoughts about his work and contemplation for the future. It's first Thursday in April, so it'll be lots of art. People will be walking in from everywhere to the various galleries, but we're hoping that when they come to our space that, again, they'll center their thoughts of, you know, reflection, and that it'll give people time to kind of, like, you know, dig in. Maybe they might want to sign up to volunteer. Maybe they'll donate to Don't Shoot. Maybe they'll, you know, get involved as interns, but we're hoping that it serves as a just call to action to be engaged, not to just be at home, not to just sit back, not to just worry, but to actually resist by participating in community.
What is Don't Shoot PDX working on right now?
Well, right now, on the other side of our gallery, we actually have our annex. And we're working with a few students, art students from PNCA, to build a art pop-up right around the corner from the art gallery, which will again serve to help support Black artists in their communities and our vulnerable community that we already advocate for. At our location, we do like food distros and things of that sort. We give away a lot of free supplies to children and families. And we do a lot of direct advocacy work for families affected by violence. So this year we're going to be opening up the space a little bit more. On the 18th and 19th, we're going to be doing art making with PNCA, which is our art school partners. They're at the Pacific Northwest College of Art, and we'll also be celebrating Juneteenth at the Blackout. Another thing that came up is we just recently moved into the Center of Social Justice with Seating Justice, and we have a suite there, which is set up as a memory lab. A lot of people know that our work with Liberated Archives, which includes like research, that's helped us kind of develop our opportunities to file these lawsuits and to advocate for our communities and to audit agency and policies that are harming us. And so having access to our own memory lab where we can invite people to come in and utilize research or, you know, thumb through our cultural library or make copies or prints or, you know, whatever they need to do to kind of process documents and materials that would otherwise be like banned or lost or censored, we wanted to make that space available to our community. So it'll be opening this Juneteenth, and it's on 510 Southwest 3rd, and it will be by appointment only.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Where can Portlanders go to learn more and get involved with you folks?
For our website, don'tshootpdx.org, and then also for the Black Gallery, it's theblackgallerypdx.com. And this Thursday, there's an Eventbrite. If you go to like our Instagram, I think on the Black Gallery PDX Instagram, I put a link to the Eventbrite because Donovan Scribes is going to have a couple of issues of the blackout, and we're going to try to see if we can get all of the artists to sign them. So if people sign up on the Eventbrite link, they'll be able to get the first come, first serve signed issues.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you so much for including us in your broadcast.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that you'd like to get out there?
No, just, you know, I think that connection to community is more important than ever, and that if people are reflecting on their involvement in protests or organizing, that if they need support, we have like mental health support available through some of the people in our network. There's a program called Protest with Purpose. I'm still obviously dealing with PTSD from organizing for so many years, but there's so many people that when we're reflecting, there's a lot of reintroduction to trauma. And so we just want to encourage people to kind of like reach out and get help. And if you got to contact us to get a referral, you know, contact us at contact@don'tshootpdx.org, and we'll do legal referrals or mental health referrals for people that need a little bit of support. And thanks for asking that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your work and your time, Teresa.
Thank you, Hannah. Thank you.
To close, I asked attorney J. Ashley Albies what she hoped to remember and carry forward from the successes of this lawsuit into this new time of difficulty.
I think we have power in community, that when we support each other and we take steps to act in concert and act together, and we take care of each other, we are incredibly powerful. No one attorney could have litigated this case. We had a team of lawyers that were incredibly talented, and everybody was working so hard to make sure that we were representing the values of our clients, that we were representing the needs of our community, and working with Don't Shoot very closely to translate those needs into the legal system and to make sure that the legal system made space for the violations in the constitutional violations that we were seeing. So to me, this case is a very important example of community protection and community defense and community action that translates into holding the government accountable when they engage in constitutional violations, that we are very powerful as a community. And with what's going on nationally, it's I think it's easy to feel isolated and alone, and the power of collective action will always combat that. And Don't Shoot Portland in particular acts on a mission of love and connection and respect for one's dignity, and those values we all hold near and dear to our hearts. And as a community, when we elevate those values and we share them with each other, we are very strong together.
You're listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, in remembrance of 5 years since Don't Shoot PDX's successful lawsuit against the City of Portland and the Trump administration. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Special thanks to Don't Shoot PDX Executive Director Teresa Rayford and J. Ashley Albies. The interim evening news director is Hanna Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. All our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is currently in our summer fundraising drive, and our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for news in depth.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Northwest Office Liquidations, a family-owned business in Portland for over 30 years, offering an inventory of office furniture, full-service office design and space planning, and liquidation services. More info at northwestofficeliquidations.com.
Hello, everyone.